absolutely the voice of the community. I'm your host, Faraji Muhammad. Thank you so much for checking in and riding with me this evening. Folks, we have started the conversation with our very own state's attorney, State's Attorney Ms. Marilyn Mosby, who is joining us live in studio tonight to talk to us about a host of things as it relates to prosecution, to what's going on in the streets and crime and violence. Also, certainly just wanted to give her take on some of the things that the governor mentioned in his State of the State of address earlier today. Now, the governor talked about a package of bills that would help to, at least he believes, to curb some of the violence here in the city of Baltimore. And we want to give an opportunity for Madam State's Attorney to kind of talk a little bit about that. The three bills are the Violent Firearms Bill, the Witness Intimidation Bill, and the Judiciary Transparency Act. I'm sorry, all of these are acts. And he talked about all of these as being a part of a concerted effort, because the issue of violence and crime in the city is an issue of crisis, an urgent crisis, he said. So, Madam State's Attorney, as we hear that from the governor coming in from Annapolis, here's a man that's saying, you know what, we need to do something right now. These bills need to be passed within the next 61 days. What's your take on it?
So my take on it is that, you know, I've addressed a number of these concerns with the governor. I think that we need to prioritize, and unfortunately, we can't continue to do the same things that haven't worked. Tougher sentences, more resources on police, more resources and personnel for prosecutors. I think that that's problematic. I think I've come up with five solutions, collaborate and use what's within the governor's purview to ensure that we're increasing the clearance rate. Let's bring in the state police. Let's have them assist the Baltimore Police Department in solving some of these homicides, right? Like, let's collaborate to remove guns from our streets. How do we do that? Let's interrupt cycles of violence. And when I say that, that requires us to confront directly the circumstances that cause the violence to erupt and to spread. So what does that mean? That means you have the ability of investing in programs in like safe streets, where mm-hmm. we know that violence interruption is actually working, right? Like, why aren't we doing that? Look what they've been able to accomplish in Cherry Hill. Mm. Like, phenomenal work down there. Collaborate to stop, you know, the violence that's being funneled between our state prisons. We just unfortunately indicted 25 corrections officers. You know, again, we know that that's what fuels violence on the city in the streets of Baltimore. Collaborate to fix the broken juvenile justice system. And I think most importantly, like when I say that we can't keep doing the same things over and over and over and again, is that he has proposed to put $1.9 million to replicate my office. Now, it's not just Baltimore City. I know that everybody wants to point to Baltimore City and say, look at them. Mm. They're the redheaded stepchild. It's an 85% increase in homicides in Baltimore County. And nowhere is there a proposal for there to be a replication of Scott Schellenberger's attorney's office, right? Like, so it's absolutely ridiculous. And when we think about what we need to do as a community, I can tell you that, you know, last year, thankfully, my prosecutors had a 95% conviction rate. However, 35% of the cases that we had to get rid of had to do with a lack of victim witness cooperation and or witness intimidation. So it's a huge issue. And I think it's problematic when you think about 92-year-olds and 79-year-olds and 18-month-olds that are being shot in broad daylight within our communities, and nobody wants to step up.
So even the governor talked about that Witness Intimidation Act, and that's you told me off air that was something that you have been working on for the past 2 years.
Yeah, I mean, we've been pushing legislation in Annapolis for the past 2 years to try to strengthen some of our witness intimidation laws.
Yeah.
One of which would allow or lessen the burden and put us in conformity with federal standards in 43 other states, that would allow us as prosecutors to use out-of-court statements of individuals when we know that the person that's accused has procured their absence in court, mm-hmm. right? Because we can trace it through jail calls or whatever else to make that connection. But the burden of proof is so high that the judges are not allowing us to do it. And so what we're saying is that, hey, let's conform Maryland standards with federal standards. Mm. Let's ensure that we are proving this by the same standards as 43 other states.
We're going to open up the phone lines in a few moments for you to pose your questions to Madam State's Attorney at 410-319-8888. We got a lot to talk to. She has little time to spend with us this evening, but we're going to try to get to all of your calls as much as you can. And, of course, we want you to post your thoughts on my Facebook page at Faraji Muhammad. Now, as we talk about this piece of Madam State's Attorney of, you know, witness intimidation in some of these bills, the fact is we're still in this we're still in this dark place.
We're really
in this dark place. And so I think people, you know, one of the big things that I was asking prior to you coming on to the show tonight is that what does justice look like for the 348 families that lost a loved one last mm-hmm. year, right?
I agree.
As much as we talk about, you know, the rehabilitation, we talk about some of the kind of the other things that we can do, but how do we give those families some closure?
I think the way that we give those families closure is to pursue justice on their behalf, right? And that's one of the reasons
why... And that looks different, right, for everybody, right?
And justice is not black and white. And
okay.
It's written in my mission statement, my vision statement. Justice is the only barometer of success for my office. And so that's the only reason why I point to the conviction rate. Because at the end of the day, if given the resources and the tools to go ahead and proceed upon a case... 9 times out of 10, we're going to find you guilty. We're going to get a conviction. Just yesterday, we were able to obtain justice for Tiffany Jones. This is a 29-year-old woman who was abducted, who was brutalized and left naked in a vacant after she was killed. Her body was burned alive. The individual, and I don't even want to give him, you know, the ability to say his name, but the individual that was convicted, he got life plus 80 years.
Mm.
We've been able to convict every single public enemy number one that's been designated by the Baltimore Police Department, with the exception of 2. And of those individuals, we're looking at cumulative 6 life sentences plus 700 years, right? So at the end of the day, we have to be able to hold individuals that prey upon the vulnerabilities of men, women, and children accountable. And we have every, you know, intention to do so. But at the same time, we have to be smart about this approach. And not everybody is to the same caliber as the BGF executioners, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, so we have to ensure that we're taking a holistic approach. We have to make an investment in our young people. You all were just talking about the squeegee kids, right?
Yeah.
That's the whole reason why, you know, from my perspective, I'm a prosecutor, so typically the traditional role of a prosecutor is to be reactionary. We can't just stop there. I created a crime control and prevention division where we've been able to touch more than 7,500 young people in the past 5 years, because I understand and recognize I'm charging 13 and 14-year-olds with murder. We have to figure out ways in which we can get to young folks before they get to the criminal justice system.
Is there, and you speaking of squeegee kids, is there anything that your office can do?
So, I mean, we can work with the mayor to develop resources. I don't have the resources to be able to employ them, but I can tell you that, you know, through my, and I'll talk about my junior state attorney program
right.
at this point, you know, but through programs out of our crime control and prevention division, where we're attempting to expose young people to the positive careers within the criminal justice system. So for the past 5 years, we have a program where we partner with the mayor's office of employment development. We actually pay these young people for 6 weeks to come every single day to my office and to go to the circuit court, district court, federal court, to go to the Foxtrot and to the 911 call center, so that they can learn about, and you're young, old enough to remember officer friendly,
right?
You know, when we had it in the school, but to build that rapport with law enforcement and to expose them to what they would otherwise have negative experiences with law enforcement for. We've touched about 260 kids just in that program. We have the pop-up events that we do on Friday nights in the summertime between the hours of 6 and 9 when we know that there's a drastic increase in youth violence. We want to ensure that our young people are being productive and we're providing meals for them, right? That we've touched more than 5,000 young people just in that program. So there are several opportunities, you know, and actually the Junior State's Attorney Program, right now, if you go to my website, stattorney.org, we are in the process of doing the applications. We usually receive hundreds of applications for a slot of only 60 students.
But and I think that the conversation has been some people feel like, you know, these young people need to get off the street. Other people need to are feeling like this activity of squeegeeing has to be institutionalized in some way, shape, or form, either by the mayor or be protected by the mayor, possibly the police department. Where does the state's attorney lie in that whole conversation? I mean, should we start to look at that? Because, I mean,
I think we definitely need to look at it. And I can tell you right now that I have no intention of criminalizing that, right? Like, I mean, and the sad thing about it is that you have little young kids out there. I see like little kids that look like they could be 5 years old. And it goes to this whole idea and concept. 28% of Baltimore's population lives in poverty. 35% of children live below poverty, mm-hmm. right? Like, we are going to criminalize poverty? Absolutely not. Not under my watch. So I do think it's a discussion that needs to be taken up by the mayor and the police commissioner. And I think everybody should be all hands on deck. But this is not the biggest problem facing Baltimore City, and it gets frustrating when this is the first thing out of everybody's mouth.
I'm sure it does. Now, one of the other pieces that I wanted to talk to you about is because, you know, along with the city problems, you have decided to show your support and stand in solidarity with another colleague, Ms. Kim Gardner, who is a prosecutor out of St. Louis. She has filed a federal lawsuit for the attacks that she has been undergoing, the alleged political attacks by her own city leaders and police unions. Union.
Yeah. I know a little bit of something about that. Right?
Well, you know, I figured you would. But Kim Gardner, you decided to go to St. Louis,
yeah,
and to show your support for that because you have actually been under attack in a lot of different ways ever since the Freddie Gray situation.
Absolutely, since Freddie Gray.
But I'm just saying, has this happened before?
Yeah. I mean,
so talk to us about, like, how did you hear about Kim? Did she call you and say, look, I need your help? Or how did that happen?
So, I mean, I think for me, I came into office in 2015, and very early on, you know, making a decision to apply one standard of justice to all, regardless of one's race, sex, religion, and occupation, mm-hmm. you know, that accountability wasn't being had across this country. And, that backlash that I received, this is pre-Trump, so, you know, I had, like, individuals, organization called Red Nation Rising. They would send me hate mail and death threats. I have a binder of hundreds of pages of hate mail and death threats and all sorts of expletives that I can't say on the radio. But going through that, when you know that you're just trying to do the right thing and you're in the heat and in the midst of your storm, it can be incredibly isolating, right? And so I felt it was important for me to go and stand with Kim Gardner, who's the first African-American circuit attorney in St. Louis, as she filed a very symbolic federal lawsuit against the Fraternal Order of Police and the city of St. Louis for a conspired sort of attempt to displace her from office and to undermine her from doing her job, and to undermine her from doing her job on behalf of poor black and brown people. Mm. So when you think about that, right, she's attempting to change and reform the criminal justice system that was designed not for individuals that look like us. I just want to be clear. Prosecutors are one of the most important stakeholders in the criminal justice system. They decide who's going to be charged, what they're going to be charged with, what sentence recommendations they're going to make. And these individuals have a direct impact on your daily life, right? That is an awesome discretion. 95% of the prosecutors making these decisions are white, 79% are white men, and as women of color, we represent 1%. of all elected prosecutors in the country. Mm. And so understanding that isolation, I want to stand with Kim and to say she's not alone and that we together are going to reform the criminal justice system despite the status quo and the keepers of the status quo who are responsible for the overcriminalization of poor black and brown people, responsible for mass incarceration, and don't believe in second chances. We're here to do a job because the people elected us, and I was there to stand with her because I can remember when, you know, I was out there by myself and these women who were there, these black women prosecutors were subsequently elected after me. And so I made a pact myself that I will always stand for women, especially black women in these positions.
And your stand has come with a huge toll and consequences. I want to play this clip of one of the messages that you received, a voicemail message, and then we'll come back and then take some calls.
How dare you come to St. Louis and say you got the back of that lousy state's attorney, Kim Gardner. She is just like you. That's why birds of a feather, that's what you are. You hate cops. You hate white people. You do everything you can to give all the blacks who are criminals every benefit of the doubt, and everybody else is suspect. Black lives only matter when a white person takes it. You blacks can kill each other all you want. In fact, I think that's the grand solution. We need to start driving around the ghettos and just dropping boxes of bullets on every street corner. Let them take each other out. Things were much better in this world, in this country, when everybody stayed in their own neighborhoods by dusk. There's only one thing worse than a fat, empowered black woman. That's a fat, empowered black woman who's got public reins in her hands. If we'd known you all were going to be this much trouble, we would have picked our own cotton.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. I can still see it bothers you.
I mean, for the most part, it's not surprising. And the only reason why I released it, as I stated, I have hundreds of you know, hate mail and death threats.
I want to read one of the emails, just partially.
Sure.
This came at I don't know if I can say the person's name or not, but I don't want to give them any extra. But they said, Marilyn Mosby, Baltimore City prosecutor, was gunned down in cold blood walking into the courthouse. This is the, what they says, the obituary of Marilyn Mosby. This was sent to you. Mrs. Mosby, who decided to prosecute six Baltimore City police officers doing the job they were sworn to do shortly after a meeting with Reverend Al Sharpton. Reverend Sharpton, who holds no public office and has been linked to several scandals, is known to take money from businesses for protection from media organized process. Even though several city police officers were in the immediate area of the shooting, not one officer came to assist when the shooting occurred. The police have no suspects, nor are they actively searching for any. A statement from the Baltimore City Police Department released simply reads, sucks to be her. Maybe the next prosecutor will recuse themselves from all politically motivated cases and use scientific forensic evidence instead of public poll evidence. Nobody will miss that N-word B, said every police officer from the United States. Then it goes on to talk about your husband and saying that he was recently gunned down outside of her office, found inside of a CVS store, and that he was found tortured and dismembered.
Yeah. I mean, again, this is not anything new, and I guess I've become somewhat desensitized to it. What I had to learn very early on in my administration, that it was bigger than me. Like it wasn't even about me personally, not to internalize it. It was about, you know, what I represent. And so, you know, upon returning in Baltimore, I found that racially expletive voicemail from an individual that was criticizing me and my support of Kim.
Yeah.
But what is also important for you to understand is that, you know, this is not anything that's foreign to black women in positions of power, right? There's a federal administration that is, you know, attacking progressive prosecution all across the country. And, you know, Larry Krasner, Mark Gonzalez, Eric Gonzalez, like there's an attack against progressive prosecutors from the federal administration. But the vitriol that black women receive is just different. It's so vicious. And so, you know, you hear this voicemail, and the one thing that I just want to point out is that we try to disassociate ourselves, but and say that this is so vulgar. This isn't something that is reflective of our values. But let me just say that this subliminally has been spread across the media outlets pertaining to me implicitly for the past 5 years. Let's think about it. You hate cops. You hate white people. You do everything that you can to give all the blacks who are criminals the benefit of the doubt. Right? When I released this video or this voicemail to the Baltimore Sun, the only part that they talked about in their article was that the woman said that I hate cops and I hate white people. Do you know how many times I've heard that? Just recently, a state senator chastised me and said that I prosecute innocent police officers because I attempted to apply one standard of justice, totally ignoring every other unprecedented challenge that we've faced in the city. When you think about what she said, black lives only matter when a white person takes it. You blacks can kill each other all you want. How many times have you heard that rhetoric when we talk about police brutality and it comes back to black on black crime?
Wow.
And the last part, which is really one that I think is intriguing, is that she's made the connection when she says, if we'd have known you were going to be this much effing trouble, we'd have picked our own effing cotton. She's made the connection between slavery and mass incarceration for you.
My goodness. My goodness. Madam State's Attorney, if it's okay with you, I just wanted to take like maybe two or three extra minutes, if that's okay.
That's fine.
And then, you know, take a couple of calls because we have people waiting just to pose some quick questions, and then we will be able to let you go. But it is mind-blowing. I use that, but I'm just trying to wrap my mind around having to deal with that when you're trying to simply do your job. You know what I mean? So this speaks volumes about how far we still have to go in this country, especially when it comes to race issues and, more importantly, when it comes to the pursuit of justice. Folks, we're going to take a final break when we come back. Just our final remarks from Madam State's Attorney Marilyn Mosby, your quick questions, and then we'll also transition into the conversation about the Great Migration as we talk to Ron Casey of Baltimore Magazine. Stay riding with us. It's For the Culture here on WEAA.
I do this for my culture, 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 culture.
Peace and welcome back to For the Culture here on WEAA. We got some few, for the final few moments of our time with our Baltimore State's Attorney, Ms. Marilyn Mosby. We're going to take a couple of calls. So much that we had to talk to the State's Attorney about. And so we're going to try to get just as many of your calls. So I ask you that you keep your questions short, sweet, and to the point. But I certainly thank you for your participation. Let me go to Dwayne, talk to me. What's your question for Marilyn Mosby?
I have a question. My question would be, when is Ms. Mosby going to run for mayor of Baltimore? That's what the people want. That's what we need. And I also want to say that, you know, my heart goes out to you for receiving, you know, the hate mail and stuff that you receive. But if it's your spiritual mission to lead, to help lead this lead us through this journey, then I stand by you, and I'm sure that all black people will stand by you. And I often say that we don't even know how bad it's going to get when we really start threatening their power.
Dwayne, thank you so much. Everybody's asking you about your run. Well, she can't file now, Dwayne. That's over with, unless she wants to be candidate number 38 or something.
No, Dwayne, I just want to say thank you so much for your confidence. But as you know, what I'm up against, and as black women prosecutors, we're perceived as an existential threat to the establishment that's constructed a system of mass incarceration. And so this role is far too important, and we've made far too much progress in trying to reform this criminal justice system that has disproportionately impacted communities of color for me to step out of it. And so there's no end game for me. I do appreciate your confidence, and I just want you to know that I'm there, and I understand and recognize that I will never be complicit in discriminatory enforcement of laws against poor black and brown people. And as long as I have breath, I'm going to fight for us.
Ms. Rita, want to have a question or comment about gun charge? Ms. Rita? Okay, Ms. Rita, we couldn't get to you. Let's go to James in Baltimore to discuss witness protection. James, what's your question for Madam State's Attorney?
Hello, Ms. Mosby?
Yes.
Nice to hear from you.
You as well, James.
I would see that it's like been this confrontation clause that they have under the Constitution,
mm-hmm.
about dealing with certain witnesses and confronting mm-hmm. them and things, mm-hmm. put people at risk. But the main focus I try to look at is a person's character. Y'all getting the wrong information from certain people. You know, it's like to be a character reference of who you're getting this information from. Because, you know, the intimidation mainly is caused by a lot of lying, you know, on certain people. That's how you get this, a lot of people going to jail.
So I agree with you, James. I think
Thank you, James.
That we do look for corroboration. But the problem that we have, unfortunately, is that this is the home of witness intimidation, where the stop snitching mentality pretty much began. And so, again, 35% of the cases that we're getting rid of and we have to dismiss have to do with a lack of victim witness cooperation. And so how do we change those dynamics, right? One of the things that we attempted to do at least last year was I launched the campaign Together We're Stronger. You're not alone. Together We're Stronger. If you go to togetherwe'restronger.com, it talks about the various services that my office has to offer for victims and witnesses of crime. And so I've attempted in the past 5 years, we've gotten record number of funding, $4.1 million to double the size of the victim witness unit. We have victim witness advocates in every division within my office. We've been able to renovate the victim witness waiting room into a therapeutic space for those that have experienced trauma while they're awaiting, you know, trial, which in and of itself can be anxiety producing. We've gone above and beyond. We created an app and a new website. We want to be able to provide the services to folks, because at the end of the day, what we need to recognize as a city is that it is a very small number of individuals that wreak havoc in our communities. And there are more of us, productive citizens, that want to change the trajectory of what's happening in our communities than there are of those individuals that define that negative perception of our city. And when we come together, we can achieve justice for those individuals. We can ensure that where our homicide clearance rate increases. But we have to take some sort of self-reflection and responsibility for where we are as a community.
Thank you so much. Kenneth, talk to us. You want to ask a question about gun charges. What's your question for Madam State's Attorney?
Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Okay, and thank you, Ms. Mosby, for being with us this evening. First thing I want to say to you is one thing I take serious in the Bible, and I'm not a very religious person, but I take this. God doesn't put anyone anywhere that he doesn't want them to be, okay? So don't let these people out here with their snotty remarks get to you. God put people where he wants them to be, and let no man put it under. Now, second thing I want to ask you about changing gun laws and making them, I think the Maryland judicial system is joking with these criminals, you know? If I'm contemplating on shooting somebody, I need to know that I'm never going to get out of jail again. If the gun law says for carrying a gun, you're going to get 5 years, I ain't going to be no parole and probation. You understand what I'm saying? If I kill somebody with a gun and the judge gives me 30 years, there's not going to be no parole and probation. You got to get tough. Maryland state laws have to be tougher. And we do need you as mayor.
Thank you so much, Kenneth, for checking in. Good to hear from you.
And I just want to say thank you, and I appreciate that. I'm a woman of faith. Romans 8:31, if God is for you, who can be against you? And so that's what keeps me grounded. And I did not release that tape for any sort of sympathy. As I've stated, I've been getting these hate mail death threats for 5 years. The only reason why I released that video, or that voicemail, is because I was being asked by the media how I could be in St. Louis standing up for Kim Gardner when, you know, the city was in so-called crisis. And I thought it was important for me to be able to illustrate why I stood with that sister. But with reference to gun laws, we have some of the most tougher gun laws in the entire country. But the question I have, I guess I would pose back, is jail really a deterrent at this point? Right? Like, I don't see it that way. And unfortunately, I'm not saying from my own perspective, but from the perspective of the young people that are coming in contact with the criminal justice system, they're no longer fearing, you know, 5 year sentences or 10 year sentences in jail. We as a community are missing the mark. Something is going on with our young people, and it's Frederick Douglass said it best. It's easier to build strong children than it is to repair broken men. And as a community, we have got to make that investment in these young people before it's too late.
We got our final call from Lee. Lee, you want to share a sentiment with the state's attorney?
Yeah, how you doing, Ms. Moley? I'm just gonna say, keep doing what you're doing. I think you're doing a hell of a job.
Thank you.
You know, man. And far as that lady down there, you know, the white lady, the redneck, she need to see one of them TV news stations when they show when the brothers come out of jail, they spend 15 and 20 years in there, and they've been innocent all that time. She need to see with some of them stories.
Absolutely.
And Lee, let me just tell you, that is one of the reasons why I stood with Kim Gardner. She started a conviction integrity unit, and her court, the court in her state, are trying to prevent her and preclude her from being and using her discretion and her authority to exonerate innocent people. As you all know, I have the only conviction integrity unit in the entire state of Maryland, with the exception of Aisha Brave Boy now. And this is what we do. And this is what, as black women, our experience is different and will continue to do.
Marilyn Mosby, Baltimore City State's Attorney. Madam State's Attorney, we thank you so much for your time tonight. Like I said, there are so many things that are on the docket that can be discussed, but we certainly would love to welcome you back for another conversation.
Absolutely.
With us.
Absolutely. Thank you, Faraji.
We appreciate you. Folks, we got to take our final break. And when we come back, the Great Migration of Baltimore. Stay right with me. It's For the Culture on WEAA. Peace and welcome back to For the Culture here on WEAA 88.9 FM and WEAA.org. Absolutely the voice of the community. I'm your host, Faraji Muhammad. We're going to end tonight's great show with a conversation about history. Yes, you might be saying, well, what kind of history, Faraji? Well, we got to talk about history in a very different way. This is Black History Month, and there's no better time for us to have a discussion about Black history other than talking about one of the most oftentimes overlooked events, but one of the most impactful events of the 20th century. Which event is that? The Great Migration of Black people from the rural South to the industrial North. Now, how large was that migration? 6 million is still considered to be the largest movement of people in the history of this country. Here to talk to us a little bit about what that migration looked like and the impact that it has made here in Baltimore City is the senior editor for Baltimore Magazine, Mr. Ron Cassie. And we're also joined by Mr. Webster Phillips, who is a photographer for the magazine, to give us some insight into how do we have a conversation, but most importantly, how do we capture this part of our history accurately so that it may never be forgotten. Mr. Cassie and Mr. Phillips, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Ron, let's start off with you, because your article starts off talking about the story of Jacob Logan. And this is a man who has he wasn't from Baltimore, but he's made his way through to Baltimore through a couple of different places, right, from New York and other places. But he was able to do something in Baltimore that many people didn't think that could be done. He was able to open up a few businesses. He was able to establish a family. He was able to really be a contributing factor for the Cherry Hill community. Talk to us a little bit about Mr. Logan.
Jacob Logan. In fact, his daughter, Francesca Brooks, I was sharing with Webster, she called me this morning. She'd gotten a couple of the issues in the mail and was going out to buy more, and she was really thankful. Without her and her, you know, and Webster and stuff, you know, doing a story like this just is impossible. Jacob Logan was born in 1920 in Rutherford County, North Carolina, rural southwestern county. He leaves his grandparents' farm, when he's 12 years old to go work for a white family in North Carolina for room and board and $1 a week. He leaves that family to go work for another white family at 15 in New York, making $10 a week in room and board. And eventually, so he's born in 1920. When World War II starts in the early 40s, he comes to Baltimore. He's heard there's good paying jobs in Baltimore down at the port, mm-hmm. like building Liberty ships. And he comes down and gets one of those jobs building Liberty ships as the defense industry, you know, just takes off in Baltimore. And, you know, gets married. Meets another woman who's a great migration story. His right. wife, Estelle, yep. is also from the South. She had been working as a downtown elevator operator, had an older sister in Baltimore. And, you know, Jacob Logan is kind of just a resilient person and a born entrepreneur. And as Cherry Hill is built in the early 40s after lots of fits and starts, for World War II veterans and defense workers who had flooded into the city, he has already opened a little corner, you know, bodega grocery store in South Baltimore, Sharp Leadenhall. Mm-hmm. He buys a used truck and he starts making deliveries into Cherry Hill because the apartments and row house are being built and there's no infrastructure yet. There's no school, no right. shopping, Cherry Hill Shopping Center's not there yet. And he turns that into enough to build another grocery store in Turner Station, and then he starts a bread company. To the point where he
Daddy
has like
Logan Bread.
Daddy Logan Bread with his own visage on the wrapper. His daughter tells the story that there was a preacher named, I think it's Daddy Grace, in Baltimore at the time, who he liked, or maybe it was a national preacher, but he liked the name Daddy Logan, and so he put his own mug on the bread and Daddy Logan Bread, and had 17 trucks making deliveries around the city at its peak.
Now, this is a story that I don't think a lot of people would know.
No, this is a guy, you know, has, you know.
I mean, because he sounds like, I mean, for that time frame, you know, being in business, you know, here's a black man in Baltimore City, which was still a highly segregated city.
Completely segregated.
Right. And he's opening up, it sounds like, about two or three different businesses. He's running these businesses. I mean, he's very successful at these businesses. He's making a huge, he's really making a name for himself, and more importantly, he's helping to build the community. Why haven't we talked about Jacob Logan?
I don't know. I think there's lots of Jacob Logans. You know, I think we know Willie Adams actually has a very similar story. He leaves North Carolina at like 15 years old as well and comes to Baltimore. And eventually has a good head for business and numbers like Jacob Logan did. Jacob Logan is unique. I mean, he clearly had a lot of personality. I found him, if you will. He passed 2 years ago. I really, it kind of breaks my heart. I didn't get a chance to meet him. He lived to be 97. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I went to a couple book presentations by Linda Morris, who wrote Cherry Hill, Raising Successful Children in Jim Crow Baltimore. And Jacob Logan's daughter, Francesca Brooks, who's, I don't want to guess her age, but she's a senior citizen. She was at both these presentations, and I met her afterwards, and she kind of was sharing her story. She was in the audience, I was in the audience, and she generously shared her father's story, which, you know, is really remarkable. And part of it, too, is that after he retires, he takes up golf.
Right.
Right? And the court golf courses, the public, so-called public golf courses in Baltimore, segregated his whole life. He'd worked for a white businessman who told him, who he caddied for, who said, there's no reason to learn how to play golf. You're never going to be able to play. He had an interest in the game as a young man, as did Willie Adams. And so when he retires from business, he picks up golf and is part of a black community in Baltimore that's desegregating the public golf courses. And on his bucket list is this, he wants to go back to North Carolina and play at Pinehurst, a world-famous course in North Carolina that was, of course, long segregated into the 60s. And so he has a remarkable journey. You know, there's no doubt about it.
Webster, I want to bring you into the course of this conversation as well. As a photographer, how do you bring this story of Jacob Logan and just the whole Great Migration element of history, how do you bring that to life through pictures?
I'm a third-generation photographer, and right now I'm working on a project where I'm archiving and cataloging my grandfather's work from the 40s to 60s. Mm. And it pretty much tells the whole story of Baltimore back then. So when you talk about businesses, it's countless businessmen. Actually, the article actually opens up to a photo of Morgan State students protesting in front of the State House for the separate but equal law. So you see signs that say 900 phys ed majors, no gym, a stable for auditorium. And then they're protesting, you know, trying to kind of get a level playing field. But then you go on to everything from, you know, businesses, the stores, the recreation. And really what I'm working on is trying to raise awareness for what we're doing online and try to get people to kind of check out these photos. Look at the business photos, see if they recognize anyone. Look at the photos in the magazine, see if they, you know, if you were to pull up this page and show it to your grandmother or elder in your family, they're bound to know someone in one of these photos.
Wow. Wow. And the fact that you found photos of Morgan State students.
It's plenty of those.
That gives a lot of, makes the institution very proud to be a part of such a movement. 6 million people have migrated from the South to the North. You mentioned in your article, Ron, that during, like, there was no census count before 1910. Talk to us a little bit how the census was able to track how many people, because it seems to me that it could probably have been more, right?
It could have been more. The census, I think, starts in 1870. But 1910 is considered the start of the Great Migration. In 1910, 90% of African Americans in the United States live in the Deep South, in the former Confederate states. Mm-hmm. At the end of the Great Migration, which is usually given as like 1970, half of African Americans in the country are now living in the urban North. So it's a total, you know, change in the population, not just from the South to North, but from rural to urban.
Right.
It's a really dramatic shift in the country's population. you know, profound implications.
Well, you know what? Speaking of implications, I wanna share something that I read that I think it speaks volumes. You really talk about that without this movement, everything from music, arts, culture, politics, all of that we have celebrated, all that we have been taught about the progress that black people have made in this country, none of that really would have happened without this great migration taking place.
Yeah, there's no Detroit and Motown, right, without the great migration. There's no big three auto manufacturers there. There's no Steel Belt. There's no City of Big Shoulders in Chicago and Chicago Blues, and there's no Harlem Renaissance. This is where people are going to work. And in the Baltimore is the same thing. The black population in Baltimore, triples during the course of the Great Migration. And, it's not just, Elijah Cummings used to talk about his parents being from South Carolina, but, it's Ethel Ennis, the First Lady of Jazz. It's Lucille Clifton, the two-time Pulitzer Prize finalist poet. It's Joyce Scott, our MacArthur Genius Grant-winning artist. It's, right. It's just on and on. And even if you get towards the end of the Great Migration, you can look at like the Colts and Orioles and the Baltimore Bullets, Wes Unseld and Earl of Pearl Monroe. These guys are coming from Southern colleges to Baltimore. And it's, a profound change. And, I don't think in Baltimore, I think the Great Migration has been, discussed and framed in Chicago, Detroit, and New York. I don't think it has in Baltimore the same way. And I'm not sure why that is.
Yeah.
It's our unique geography. We're up south, people will say. We're not quite. And people, obviously coming from the deep south, they're fleeing violence, political oppression.
Sure.
They're looking for economic opportunity. They're looking for something closer to full citizenship. And they're not quite getting those things in Baltimore. Not that they're getting it in Chicago, Detroit, either New York, but there's still, Jim Crow is really present in Baltimore. So it's a more, I think, nuanced and complicated story in Baltimore.
Absolutely, absolutely. Folks, we have been talking to Mr. Ron Cassie, senior editor of the Baltimore Magazine, Webster Phillips, photographer for the Baltimore Magazine, as they talk about their latest issue, The Great Migration. This is the movement of more than 6 million African Americans from the rural South to cities in the North. This issue of Baltimore Magazine is available on newsstands, but more importantly, learning about this level of history, the impact that it has made on Baltimore. Webster, I want to get some final thoughts from you, sir, in regards to, as much as we learn of this history, we got these pictures. What is the biggest thing that you've learned as you worked on this this story?
Well, I do have to say, I do have a photo in this issue on the back page of the issue, but I actually don't work for the Baltimore Magazine.
Oh, okay.
I'm part of a separate project, which is the I. Henry Photo Project.
Yes, sir. And, I apologize for that.
Oh, no, you're good. You're good, man.
I'm trying to give you a job that you already.
I'll take it, man. But mostly what I'm trying to do is kind of shed light on Baltimore, on the Pennsylvania Avenues, on, the Willie Adams and the Dr. Cambers and a lot of other people who might not be as well known as a lot of the New Yorkers and people and kind of movers and shakers from that time, but kind of shine light on Baltimore's story. I think a big reason why the Baltimore story isn't recognized is because the evidence isn't at people's fingertips, which is what I'm working on. There's actually a article on the last page of the Baltimore Magazine. There's a family of 9 people. We actually painted a mural on Calvert and Federal. Michael Owen painted this mural working with us, and it's a family of 9 people. And a woman was driving up Calvert Street one day, Monica Bland, and she recognized this photo. It was her family.
Wow.
And up until this time, we didn't know who these people were. We didn't have much information on it. But she stopped. We had a phone number and a contact on the mural. And she called me. She said, "Hey, I was riding up the street. This is my family." So what I'm doing now is I'm visiting senior centers and retirement communities, and I'm bringing the archive with me, and we're showing them images, we're projecting images on the screen, and we're talking to the elders and trying to get the historical information to go along with these photographs. So when we do make them available as a teacher's aid, as a learning aid, the information is right there.
Let me ask you, Mr. Cassie, when we talk about this moment in our history, this movement, What is it that you want readers of The Great Migration in the Baltimore Magazine, what do you want them to learn or walk away from after reading your piece?
There's a lot. First, I just want to echo what Webster said. The Baltimore story often isn't known because there isn't the photographic evidence, which makes it hard to tell. I just say, as a journalist, this story is not possible without Webster doing this kind of work. That documentation is crucial, not just to make... And his grandfather, by the way, was the best Baltimore photojournalist, I think, ever. And I don't think people even question that. That's how beautiful the work is as well. I mean, the piece itself, the idea came from, I think, like 2 years ago, we did a cover story on called City of Immigrants, about the European immigration into Baltimore. Mm-hmm. And we celebrate, you know, I think in the media a lot, Polish immigrants in Baltimore, German immigrants, Irish immigrants, people coming, nothing but, buying a ticket to get on a boat. And I don't think the migration story is celebrated in the same way. These are often single people with little education, with only a few dollars in their pocket, leaving behind everything they know, all their family. There wasn't a telephone in every house in 1920. There wasn't Skype. They might not see their family again. Might be a year or two. Might be a death is the next time. So, to celebrate those stories and, also to recognize that this culture is just, that we have is just, to frame it around that there was these people taking these enormous risks, coming here, starting new families in Baltimore. That's really important. And also, there's really, struggles they're facing as well.
Real struggles.
Real struggles when you talk about the Jim Crow segregation they faced when they got here.
And they're leaving legacies like Webster Phillips.
Definitely.
They have created this, like these generational legacies have been cultivated, and now we're just starting to unearth so many of these stories and hear from so many of these peoples. And I think it only adds to what people thought of Baltimore, because we know Baltimore has a rich history in a lot of ways. But to hear the stories, to see it chronicled in such a way, especially in a major publication such as the Baltimore Magazine.
It brings it to life.
It brings it all to life. And this is something that we can teach the next generation today.
Definitely.
About what has happened yesterday. So, Ron Webster, I thank you personally.
Thank you.
And I'm
thank
glad
you.
That we had the opportunity to kind of showcase the work that is being done, because I don't think that people should overlook the fact that this happened, but more importantly, the impact and power. Folks, that's going to do it for me. I want to thank my very special guest, Ron Cassie, Webster Phillips. I want to thank Madam State's Attorney, Marilyn Mosby, and I want to thank you for joining us in the conversation. Stay tuned. Up next is In the Groove. I'm Faraji Muhammad. Look forward to talking to you tomorrow. As always, never be afraid to challenge what's wrong. Stand for what's right while being yourself in the process. Talk to you tomorrow. Peace.
Promoting the